I'll call to order the 1,295th meeting of the Board of Directors and begin with the motion to approve the agenda. And I'd ask for consent to amend the agenda to include an additional administrative item as included in the package before us, which is an approval to amend the Vienna 2 parking garage project agreement and facility lease. This is in concert with the refinancing, and it saves us all some money. With that, I'd entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Properly moved and seconded. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. The next item before us is approval of the minutes of our June 16th meeting. I'd entertain a motion of approval. Is there a second? All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Next is our public comment period, and we do have six individuals signed up. Just remind those who have signed that there is a two-minute limit on your comments. I also noticed that it appears that virtually everyone signed up is choosing to address the segue topic. If we do get into a lot of repetition, I try to ask these folks to share some unique aspects, or if there's a particular point they wish to emphasize, that'd be fine. But again, we just want to be sure to hear different aspects of your concerns. The first speaker signed up is a Dan, and I apologize if I mispronounce the name, Matosh. Dan Matosh. M-A-T-T-A-U-S-C-H. If you please, sir, we move the microphone actually to keep you from being in a hole like you were the last time. The topic is segue.
Good morning. My name is Dan Matosh. I'm a Segway HT user. I live on Capitol Hill in D.C. and also work in the district. I, like many other district residents, do not own a car and rely on Segways and the Metro exclusively for transportation. I've used my Segway on the Metro since July of 2003, over 2 years, and I'm an example of the fact that the use of Segways is safe and promotes the purposes of Metro, i.e. reducing the number of cars on the road. Segway users, like other commuters, rely on the Metro for transportation. There is no reason to deny Segway users access to the Metro. First, there is no indication that Segways pose a safety risk. I'm not aware that there is more than one Segway in the Metro at any given time. During the 2 years that I have taken my Segway into the Metro, I have never seen another during rush hour, except for those used by Metro employees in the station. Second, permitting Segways in the Metro does not add to congestion. Besides the fact that at most one Segway may be present, if at all, during rush hour, the device itself is no wider than a person's shoulders and takes up less room than the suitcase of a Metro passenger traveling to the airport or Union Station, and of course is a fraction of the size of a bicycle. The board's statement that there would be a negative impact on the riding public if Segways are used without restriction indicates to me that people like me don't matter to Metro. It's also evident that Metro did not consider individuals with disabilities when it developed this policy. I have family who do not live in this area. When my 82-year-old grandmother, who requires the assistance of a Segway, comes to visit me, she will be permitted to use her Segway in the Metro under the recommended policy. She will have to jump through numerous hoops before she can use her Segway. Frankly, by the time all these hoops have been jumped, I expect that her visit will be over and she will have been denied use of the Metro. To summarize, the stated purpose for this tariff to curb congestion does not make sense in light of reality. At this time, there are a minimal number of Segway users who are on the Metro during the rush hour and the unrestricted times. Given the limited space that a Segway occupies, it seems as though I and other users of Segways are being singled out. This Segway is not a recreational device to me. I have relied on Metro for 18 years, and let me reiterate my concern that Segway users are being unfairly singled out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Our next speaker is Jeff Lanterette. Again, the topic is Segway. Mr. Lanterette. Sir, please proceed to the microphone, sir.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Lauderette. I'm a resident and small business owner in Virginia and work for businesses in the D.C. metro area. I, like many others, leave my car at home and only use the Segway and Metro to get to work every day. In fact, I was born in this area and never once used Metro before I bought the Segway. As you may know, just in the past May, the Washington Post reported that the district has the third worst traffic congestion in the United States. My commute begins in Springfield, Virginia. By car, this commute takes upward of an hour and a half. Using the Metro with my Segway, my commute has been cut in half. As my job requires me to make numerous stops throughout the district, it's necessary that I be able to use my Segway to get from job sites that are close to, but oftentimes blocks from, a Metro stop. Using my Segway, I will no longer have to incur costs to park my car, only to move it to another job site a few blocks away. I am also cutting down air pollution by utilizing public transportation. However, if the tariff is to pass, myself and others in similar situations are being deterred from taking advantage of public transportation. It would no longer be feasible for me to use my Segway for work, as my commute, like nearly everyone, requires me to travel during rush hour. I cannot imagine that WMATA envisions this tariff to discourage the use of public transportation and require people like myself to have to resort in using non-environmentally friendly means to earn their living. I must also call into question WMATA's declared intention to the tariff to curb congestion on the Metro during rush hour. As someone who has used the Segway on the Metro during that time, I can personally testify that I have yet to see another Segway user during rush hour. Further, Segways are no wider than a dolly and no longer than most luggage and can be easily collapsed to a smaller size. Yet WMATA has not restricted their use on Metro. Not only is there currently no cause for concern over increased congestion if the Segways are to be used during rush hour, there are not even enough users of Segway during the time that there is a justifiable concern for the tariff to be imposed at this time. For these reasons, I request the tariff not be passed so that I and others can continue to take advantage of public transportation, thereby reducing our commutes, our cost of having to park, and our harm to the environment. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Our next speaker will be Bruce Dixon. Mr. Bruce Dixon.
My name is Bruce Dixon. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C. I have practiced law here for a little over 30 years. I live in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I'm also disabled. I use a Segway. About 5 or 6 years ago, I began using a wheelchair to get around, and then the Segway came out, and I immediately acquired it, and I have used it literally wherever one would expect one would take a wheelchair. I use it all the time, wherever I am, including in my home. I travel a lot. I go through airports many, many times. I'd say twice a week I'm out of town, through National Airport or Dulles. The Segway takes me from a taxi to the gate of the plane through security. I also use Amtrak to get to New York or back, and I use Metro. Fairly frequently, I'll take Metro from Friendship Heights station down to my office at Metro Center. I'm here to register my strenuous objection to the proposal before you. As a Segway user, as a disabled person, and as a lawyer who believes that this agency should comply with the law like all of us have to. And while there are many problems with the proposal before you, the main one, the one that bothers me the most, is that your proposal is plainly, unambiguously against the law. The Americans with Disabilities Act, specifically Section 36.301, that was passed a while ago. I wasn't disabled at the time. It really didn't bother me. I wasn't concerned about it. But then I became concerned. Like many of you, I wasn't disabled, and it really wasn't a big issue. But as I became disabled, I learned how valuable that law is. And valuable for policy reasons that you all ought to be aware of, and you ought to certainly take into account in passing various resolutions like this proposal. One of the important aspects of that law is that it destigmatizes those who have disabilities. You know, unless you're disabled, you really can't appreciate just how important it is not to be stigmatized. Yes.
Up your comments because your time period has elapsed. Or if you could care to share my copies of that.
I have my written comments. But I think the important point for you all to be aware of is security, safety reasons. Those are obviously important things. Those are important things to the National Transportation Security Agency, which oversees our going through airport security. Never once, either at Amtrak or going through a single airport in this country, over 20 of them, have I ever been asked to prove that I'm disabled? Have I ever been asked to go through the process that you all are proposing, that I have to go to a lawyer, to a doctor, that I have to actually have a certificate and carry that certificate around with me when I'm using a Segway on the subway system? As one, a number of years ago, back in the 40s, had to wear a Star of David going through Germany, if one was Jewish.
Mr. Dixon, thank you. Your time has elapsed.
Thank you.
Our next speaker.
Do not pass this proposal.
Thank you, sir. Our next speaker is Brooks Powers. Brooks Powers.
Good morning. My name is Brooke Powers, and I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. I'm a former Montgomery County Fire Rescue Lieutenant. I've got over 10 years of experience. I've got almost 100 hours in metro-related safety, tunnel rescue, rail car extrication training. I ride my Segway almost daily through the Grosvenor Station. I've done so for nearly a year without a single complaint or a single safety concern. I'd like to discuss the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that's here and on our internet message board as we listen to some of the facts that are brought up here. I think the board has gotten a lot of bad advice. Bad advice as to which other transit systems prohibit Segway use, as was referred to earlier. Bad advice as to how far a Segway continues in balancing mode. Someone said 35 feet. It's actually 3 feet. Bad advice equating a Segway with a bicycle for policy purposes. Segways are designed specifically for use among pedestrians. Segways have the same footprint as a person, and I don't know anyone with a mobility impairment who uses a bicycle as a mobility aid. And bad advice from the police chief, who testified at the previous board meeting that Segway is prohibited in most local jurisdictions. That is absolutely false, and I call on her to correct her testimony. In fact, nearly every local state, Segways are permitted, which may conflict with Metro's enforcement capability. And bad advice from someone who asserted the last meeting, I'd hate to have somebody run over my foot with that. You're much safer having somebody run over your foot with a low-pressure tire than a woman's high heel, which exerts the same pressure per square inch as an elephant. And you've got bad advice from whoever wrote this policy who couldn't even describe the electronic personal assistive mobility device adequately. You already have data on Segway use on the system, a 3-year, almost near-perfect safety record. Metro is America's transit system. And not only is everyone looking to WMATA as a policy leader, but your customers and your constituents are looking at you to make policy competently. Thank you.
Sir, our next speaker is Ann Kinkella. Ann Kinkella. That we provide for the disabled.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Ann Kinkella, and I'm a member of the E&D Committee, WMATA's E&D Committee. We did review We had a briefing on the proposed policy that is before the board today, and we did approve it. However, the policy and the briefing that we had is different than what is worded here in your policy. This does not take into consideration, the policy that you're about to vote on does not take into consideration persons with disabilities who may be visiting the area and do not have any registration in your system. Also, it is illegal to require a person with disability to register their devices, whether they're canes, segways, wheelchairs, scooters. The Assistive Technology Act of 1998 defines assistive technology as any item, place, of piece of equipment, or product system, whether required, commercially modified, or customized, that is used to increase, maintain, or improve functional capabilities of individuals with disabilities. The Segway does not need WMATA approval. It is covered under the Assistive Technology Act of 1998. Just as FDR's homemade wheelchair would have been covered. Another issue with the proposed policy is the time restrictions on persons who are not disabled bringing their segways into the system. If there were any policy to be considered, I would think the most logical policy would be that all persons, with the exceptions of the disabled, should walk their segways through the system. There should be no time restrictions on it. If you're not sure whether a person is disabled, you can ask them, because some people do have invisible disabilities, just as the gentleman who was up here earlier. He almost looks normal. And that's all I really have to say. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Our last speaker is Mr. Dennis Jaffe. Normally, with the policy, we would not allow the same speaker one meeting after the other, but since we do have enough time this morning, the chair will exercise discretion. Let Mr. Jaffe speak.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Is this microphone working?
Yep.
Hear you.
We can hear you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Kaufman, I didn't understand the comment you just made.
Under our policy, just in keeping, is actually in keeping with the same policy for the Fairfax County governing body, we do limit the number of times in a period where we will hear from the same speaker in an effort to open up opportunities for more speakers. Since today we have comparatively few speakers versus the overall comment period, I've chosen to allow you since it falls within the comment period.
I appreciate that. It may seem that you hear from me more often than it is. I think the last time I spoke was 3 months ago. I might be incorrect on that. The members, on behalf of Washington, D.C. chapter of Sierra Club, the members and alternate members of the Board of Directors are to be congratulated for recognizing the importance of showing the public that the agency is taking steps to open doors, not only for passengers themselves, but for passenger input. Mr. White deserves to be congratulated for his welcome openness in allowing citizens participating in online chats to pose questions which reflect a broad range of questions, including some sensitive ones. The town hall meetings are very worthwhile and productive forums for citizens to raise questions about service and other issues. We would like to make one suggestion for the town hall meetings, and that is to allow people to ask questions without their being screened at just the next town hall meeting to see how it goes. Not to get rid of the cards, which do offer benefits, but to allow, even just for the next town hall meeting, as a pilot test, to see how it goes, to strengthen people's confidence in the openness of the agency. We wish to commend Chairman Kaufman in particular for his leadership in paving the way to establish a Riders Advisory Council for the agency, for giving Sierra Club the opportunity to participate in its development, and for providing the general public the opportunity to weigh in on the proposal. Most importantly for today, we wish to repeat our suggestion that the board allow public input at committee meetings. Some board members have indicated their commitment to support this suggestion, and some board members have acknowledged appropriately the obvious, appropriately for any policymaking body. Consequential discussions and decisions are made at committee meetings. Allowing public comment at regular board meetings is a step forward, but alone it is insufficient. It's like asking a dinner guest to share his or her food preferences after the meal has been largely prepared. We point out that at the meeting at which the discussion took place for rules on public comment, no public comment was permitted. One other note, we believe that regularity regarding sign-up procedures, particularly timing, is important so that people know what to expect. Mr. Zimmerman helpfully pointed out at last Thursday's meeting the value of allowing people to sign up in advance. The one concern that we want to add is that if a time is established at which people are to sign up in advance, that if people arrive at that time and they then see that the sign-up time started 20 minutes earlier than they expected and there was a rush of organized people just to sign up, whether by Segway or Sierra Club or anyone, then they get shut out. Regularity would be appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. That completes the public comment period. Next is the report by the General Manager, Mr. White.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My July board digest is in front of you. I'll just touch on a couple of items that are in here. One, I want to remind you of four additional partial shutdowns that are planned between now and Labor Day on the orange and red lines during four separate weekends for our continuing track maintenance and infrastructure renewal projects. We do know that this has a level of inconvenience to our customers, so we want to continue to try to get that word out to everyone well in advance so they can make their travel plans accordingly. And these specific dates and the specific locations for the remainder of this summer are in front of you in the Board Digest report. Would also like to report a very successful launch July 10th on the DC Circulator Service. Our Director Tangolini, Mayor Williams, members of the Council, Congresswoman Norton and others were there for a very, very successful launch. The first week, the bus fares were free, and I think just the overall appearance of the bus gives it a feel that it is a very different kind of bus service. We expect that the ridership numbers are going to steadily grow, and we look forward to that service maturing. This is the first two of four planned circulator routes, and hopefully we can see the full vision of these four routes unfold over time as additional resources become available. On the ridership side, we do have our fiscal year 2005 year-end ridership information completed, and for this past fiscal year, the Metro system carried 343.8 million trips. That's 2.3% more than a year ago. On Metrorail, we carried 195.2 million trips, and that was 2.7% better, including the month of June of 18.5 million trips, which is the single highest month in Metrorail's history. And Metrobus carried 148.6 million trips, and that's a 1.8% increase in the previous year. We'd also like to report to you that part of the Metromatters program of planned spending, we're now able to move forward with spending some money on some deferrals that had taken place, about $34 million of station cooling deferrals that had to take place. And then obviously in these very, very hot weather months, those impacts are clearly felt in certain of our stations. And now we're able to move forward with replacing 8 cooling towers, 5 chiller units, and 40 station air conditioning units with this $34 million. And that work will be done and upgraded over the next 5 years. Our Smart Trip vending machine sales continue to grow exponentially. For the past year, we had 5 million transactions totaling $87 million in sales revenue, and that's a 42% transaction increase and a 57% revenue sales increase from just the previous year. Likewise, our Metro Check program sales continues to grow exponentially. In the last year, $215 million of Metro Check sales compared to a goal that we had of $175 million. And the program currently now has about 230,000 employees who are clearly our regular rush hour users participating in both the federal government and private sectors. And Mr. Chairman, that does conclude my report. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions of Mr. White or comments? Mr. Lynn?
I guess this is a question to Peter. Do we have any ideas of how much of our Metro, our Smart Trips and Metro Checks are purchased with debit or credit cards?
We do have those statistics. I don't have them right here, though.
And do we also capture what the transaction fees are that we pay?
Yes, we do.
Could we have that provided to the board?
Yes, we can, certainly.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. White, I know you mentioned this in our earlier committee, but since this meeting is actually being live cast via computer, if you had any comments or Chief Hansen had any comments concerning today's attack in London.
Yes, I will just give you a quick overview. I know the Chief has been in regular and constant communications with officials at the federal, state, and local level, so I'd like to defer to her. But again, today there were a series of events that took place in the London Underground, and I believe on at least one of the buses as well, that has led to some shutdowns of stations and certain lines in the London Underground. We have remained in a code orange status since the last set of incidents, which were just 2 weeks ago in London. So we will remain, obviously, in that heightened condition. We are actively increasing our communications with our employees for their continued vigilance, messaging to our customers, asking them to continue to be of service and reporting any unusual circumstances to us. We're participating and facilitating regional calls of the other transit system providers, the county-based bus systems, the commuter rail, and the Amtrak system for sharing of information on that. We've basically stopped any kind of planned contractor work in the system and are using all of our time and access to the system for nothing but inspection processes to ensure that we're doing constant searches throughout the system. And that's sort of a general overview, and I'd like to defer to the Chief to give us any other updated information that she might have.
I just want to talk about deployment of police personnel throughout our system. We do have U.S. Capitol Police and, I'm sorry, U.S. Park Police, Arlington County, Prince George's County doing special attention. Fairfax County has their SWAT team doing sweeps. The U.S. Capitol Police are at Union Station and Capitol South. We have Federal Protective Service Police at Federal Triangle, Federal Center, Archives, Longfellow Plaza. The Metropolitan Police has two officers assigned to stations during rush hour, and their SWAT team is partnering with our SRT team, which is a SWAT team, to do sweeps. We obviously have held over an assortment of people and are trying to constantly and daily change our deployment so that we're not doing the same thing every day. The information that comes out of London will help us with future strategies and deployments. I was meeting with the NCR DHS office yesterday with a number of federal partners to discuss getting some of the specific information from the event of 2 weeks ago so that we can make sure that we're looking at our infrastructure properly and using technology in the best way possible. And we'll be looking for today's event to get information to do a similar type of activity.
Questions of Chief Hansen? I just want to commend you, Chief, for your work. Is this the first time or one of the first times we've had such an array of additional law enforcement communities brought to bear for protection of our system?
Yes, sir. After Madrid, we really reached out to local partners and encouraged folks to get the kind of training that both my shop and Fred's shop co-sponsor to familiarize local law enforcement with our environment. The events of Madrid did encourage our law enforcement partners to take advantage of that train. Particularly their explosive detection canines came in to familiarize themselves. If you remember during the inauguration, we had TSA screeners in a transit environment. It was the first time that was done in the nation, as well as we have canine from all over the United States here supplementing our folks. So the events of London have really, I think, made people recognize the vulnerability of transportation. Some of the conversations, we hosted a huge presentation last week where folks from both rail and bus came, and MARC and Amtrak, so that we could regionally brief our colleagues, and we had officials, high-ranking officials from all the police departments, on the vulnerabilities of the transportation infrastructure, not just Metro, but the other bus service and rail, commuter rail throughout this region, so that people can identify where those vulnerabilities are in their jurisdiction and then support us in providing the protection to their customers. But you're correct in the deployment, and we're looking to develop a partnership, and particularly with Metropolitan Police, Capitol Police, ourselves, Amtrak, Arlington County, Pentagon Police, to have some kind of sustaining effort after we leave Orange Alert so that our local colleagues will continue to join us in providing a visible presence in our system.
Ben?
Chief, and I think I'd just like to express this. I think as both a rider and a board member, this region is well served by you being the head of our Metropolitan Police Force. And I think both what you have been able to do visibly on television in terms of your presentations, but also just knowing of what you've done internally within our organization, I think should give a lot of us in these troubling times a lot more comfort that you head our organization in this capacity. And I just like to say that publicly at this time.
I appreciate that, but I have to tell you that you have a team of people who sit here, and my colleague here, their folks have pushed stuff out to the internet. I think the very dynamic piece on evacuations, which was done years ago, once again, some of the corporate communication pieces we do here are copied across the United States, and some of the work that people just do, Mr. Field went ahead and stopped all contracting activities because we have regular conversations about the importance of good housekeeping and a variety of other things. So you really have a team here who are united to make the system as safe as it can be.
And the fact that you know that you mentioned the team is also a reflection of what you are as the leader of your police force. It just reinforces my comment.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you, Chairman. Oh, Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I just would like to know. I mean, I appreciate the action to stop the contracting, and I'm quite sure it's justified. But as a member of this board, I think I'm duty-bound to inquire as to whether there's a cost associated with that. And if so, how much is this? What is the imposition on our budget?
Well, the contract work is typically scheduled for night work. So based on information that we've gotten from London, it was necessary to do that. I don't know what the cost is as of yet. We may be able to resume work as we get the information from London. So I don't know what the impact is right now, the financial impact.
Well, I think it's important for this board, but also for the public, to know, you know, just what is the impact of these types of actions. And you know, this contributes, obviously, to the cost of running the system. I'm not saying it isn't a necessary cost. It is a necessary cost. But if you would, Mr. White, let us all know just what this has added to our operating costs. Thank you.
Anyone else? Next, we'll turn to a report by the Planning Development Committee. Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Planning Development Committee met on July 7th and has a couple of items for your approval. Staff sought committee concurrence and Board of Directors approval on the Metro Matters Yard Expansion Program for a couple of actions, one of which is the adoption of the public hearing staff report and general plans and final staff recommendations related to the yard modifications necessary at the Brentwood Yard. The other is the authorization for the award of two design-build contracts for the rail yard expansion projects at Greenbelt, Shady Grove, and Brentwood. And before you, the Brentwood Yard is, I'm sorry, the public hearing staff report is resolution identified as item A. And the other two I mentioned are, I believe, item B. And so starting with the first one, again, the resolution identified as item A for the Brentwood Yard modifications, I move approval of the motion on behalf of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, clarification.
Ms. Knapp.
I had some concern about the way this approval is packaged. Mr. Zimmerman, I think if you will examine this document, it's hard to learn where A starts and B begins. And since what we are accomplishing here is approval of a hearing, a staff hearing report, I think you should have two separate items on the agenda. One for the public hearing report and then one for the contract. I had to read very carefully to determine that we were approving contracts because they're the way this is packaged. So
is that a motion to this add, Sirian?
Yes.
Well, hang on a second. So you want to divide the resolution?
Right, because, I don't know if this is a practice here, but we should not be presented with contract approvals packaged in with other actions.
I didn't think contract approval was in this resolution.
Oh, that's what it says here.
The contract approval is not in the resolution. It is in the MEAD document that is behind the resolution. There are two separate actions that got reported through the Planning and Development Committee. They are both packaged together, but the resolution that you have in front of you is just for the public hearing staff report. And then the MEAD document, which follows that, has the actions with respect to the contract authorization.
And I guess I was confused, too, because I guess I was suffering from the same confusion, because the resolution does not refer to the contract. Are you saying it's implicit in that if you approve this resolution, you're approving the contract, too?
The MEAD document has two actions associated with it in the MEAD
document. Well, the approval of the resolution carries with it the approval of the contract.
No. That's not in the resolution does not refer to the contract. It just refers to the public hearing staff report and the approval of the general plan.
And you then anticipate we take a separate action on the contract?
If it is presented as one item. The MEAD document refers to both items. The resolution that is presented in front of the MEAD document refers to only the public hearing staff report and the general plans, because that's the procedure and practice that Metro has employed in the past.
Okay. I think Mrs. Mack certainly has made her point.
Yes.
So now help me with the rest of this.
Sure.
The resolution I took to be just what is described and what it says. How does the contract get approved?
By the approval of the MEAD document.
We do not approve MEAD documents. Boards adopt resolutions. The MEAD document is a complicated acronym for a staff report. That's what this is, a staff report. We don't approve staff reports. We approve actions. So at what point do we do that? I guess I had assumed, as Mrs. Mack had, that having approved the acceptance of the hearing report, we would then act to approve the contract, which it seems to me is the appropriate action for the board to take.
Yes. I would suggest that you have one motion, if the board sees fit, to adopt the resolution, and then a second motion to approve the contract action.
Thank you. That was actually my intention, Mr. Chairman. I think Mrs. Mack's point is well taken. So if it could be understood that the resolution is just what it says on it, which doesn't actually, I think, anywhere refer to the contract, that I interpret the resolution exactly as it is, which is the approval, the acceptance of the public hearing staff report and the amendment of the regional plan as it is stated in the resolution. And I would then move subsequently, assuming this passes, for award of the contract.
Chair will accept the motion as you presented, sir. Is there a second to this motion?
Second.
It's been seconded by Mr. Smith. I was sat next to you in the disease spread, Bob. Seconded by Mr. Smith. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Mr. Zimmerman.
Then I would further move that the board authorize the award of two design-build contracts for the rail yard expansion projects at Greenbelt, Shady Grove, and Brentwood.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Smith.
Yeah, I have a question again.
Ms. May.
Why are we approving two contracts in one? I mean, this seems awfully balkanized to me. I don't know why. It's packaged. I mean, I'm sorry, but whatever the right word is.
Anti-balkanized.
I mean, do we typically just do that? What's the word?
We've gone far enough down this track.
Do we typically do this? I mean, I just.
Mr. White?
I'll have Mr. Salpeus explain how the procurement methodology was undertaken. At the high level, this procurement was for work done at two separate facilities under one procurement process, one being the Brentwood facility and the second one being the Shady Grove and the Greenbelt facility. So with that general explanation, I'll have Takis explain that this was a best value contract and what the factors were in terms of how the recommended actions are taking place.
Yes, we solicited this proposal to go both ways, to select one contractor or we select two contractors, or for that matter, three contractors, depending on the best value negotiations, where the authority will be best served. at the end of the day, 7 months later, we made the decision the best value for the agency is to have two contractors. While we're recommending approval for Hanson Phillips to do 2 yards and the Clark Corporation to do the Breadwood Yard. And we thought that was the best value selection.
First, before I recognize Mr. Graham, just see if Ms. Mackey.
Well, go ahead. I'll have something after Graham. Mr. Graham. But you.
You know, we all strive on this board. Is there a new sound system in this room? There's an awful lot of. Did you do something to them? No. Okay. I don't know. I'm the only one noticing it, apparently. But we all strive to do the appropriate thing on this board. But, you know, it has come to my attention that there's a serious question about whether this proposal represents the best value. I'm prepared to go into detail, but I'd rather not. But the fact of the matter is there's a question being raised, and I think it merits consideration that there could be a $1.4 million savings to this authority, which is a lot of money, $1.4 million, if we were to take a different approach with these contracts. And, you know, and I am concerned when this comes to my attention. I'm concerned. I'm not suggesting. I don't feel comfortable moving this result today because that wouldn't be fair to everyone. But I would at least like to know that this issue had been reviewed carefully, and that we were absolutely sure that this was not a reasonable option for us to take. Because if somebody puts on the table, you're going to save $1.4 million if you don't do what you're about to do. I got to pay attention to that. And I think some of you know what I'm referring to, and others don't. But would it be problematic if we put this off to permit a staff review of this issue so that we could consider this at our next meeting? Would that be a problem?
I recognize Mr. Linton. If I could hear from staff in response to Mr. Graham's concern.
Well, I would like to respond to both, Mr. Graham, to the $1.4 million and the time pressure. After the process was over, one of the two contractors sent us a letter in and said, if you give me all the yards, and he included also the option, as an option, we had Alexandria Yard. With the three, we put Alexandria also, because we were afraid that pricing escalation in this region, we might not be able to award one of the major contracts, while we put as an option Alexandria. That's always we do as engineers, we do the contingency planning. For this contractor sent us a letter, Mr. Graham, and said, I give you $1.4 million rebate if you give me the entire contract with the 4 yards. We reviewed his proposal, and we concluded the following two. A, was after the fact a contractor proposes an unsolicited proposal. In order to have one contractor make unsolicited proposal, we had to open the process to the rest of the contractors. Therefore, here we go, Mr. Graham, on a very complex procurement like this, after 7 months of best value negotiations, we had to go another 2, 3, maybe 4 months to entertain again from the beginning the rebate. For that, we sat down, we went through with our attorneys, our procurement staff, everybody, and we made a recommendation to you 2 weeks ago, the best way for the authorities to go as we proposed. Regarding the timeline, as you know, we need to have all these things done by December 08, because that's when the system is going to go to 8-car operation, gradually. But we're running against time.
Well, if I just have one follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. We certainly all are committed to a fair process, you know, where everyone gets a good opportunity. I mean, would it be possible to invite the other contractor to also submit a bid on all the work? I mean, if we're looking at this type of savings, I mean, is it worth 30 days for us to see if we couldn't save $1.4 million?
We need to start the process again. As I understand it, Mrs. O'Keefe can help me here. As we understand it, we have to start from the beginning. After the fact, one of the two contractors said, oops, if you give me the whole job, I give you economies of scale, $1.4 million. Now we need to...
The other problem is that they were saying that we needed to award an option that is not funded under the Metro Matters contract. We needed to award another yard that we don't have money for was the condition under which this contractor was going to give us this economy of scale, $1.4 million reduction. So it's not even an option for us because it's not inside of the program. We don't have the financial resources to do it. The only reason why it was packaged was as an option was depending upon the pricing, we may needed to have gone to another yard for whatever reason. The contractor could do that yard more cheaply than the yard that was planned under the program. So we would not be able to accept the offer because it's not fundable.
Okay. I'm satisfied. I withdraw the recommendation because I think you've responded to the issues that I wanted to raise. Thank you.
Ms. Cabin, no question?
Questions.
Ms. Mack.
Well, I just want to go back to my original concern. I think we made the point about making sure that we separate out independent actions, but these are reasonably large contracts, and so in the future, I'd not like to see contracts bunched together. I mean, I would like to see us approve. These contracts are in the tens of millions of dollars, so I think they each deserve their separate action by the board.
We will do that. Your point is well taken. I mean, we generally speaking, we just go directly to the board with these contract awards, but we were sensitive to that a lot of money is being spent, which is the reason why we brought it through the committee in the first instance. But I will concede to you that it was packaged in a somewhat confusing way, and let us try to avoid that confusion in the future.
Mr. Chairman, if you know, just to close that out, and that if contract awards are made explicit actions by the board to authorize it, the award of the contract, I think that's important too, so that there's no question afterwards about what the board did or didn't do.
Right, we have a motion that's been duly put forward and seconded. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Anything else, Mr. Zimmerman?
That will do it. Thank you.
Next, we turn to the report by the Administration Committee. Mr. Deegan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Administration Committee also met on Thursday, July 7th, 2005, and we have two action items before us today. The approval of a resolution for submission of the federal fiscal year 2006 Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Goal to the Federal Transit Administration. The committee reviewed staff's proposal and set the federal fiscal year 2006 DBE goal at 16%. The overall goal is 16% and is to be achieved by 15% through race-conscious measures and 1% through race-neutral measures. Staff pointed out that the goal tracks a reduction of federal dollars to WMATA for construction and recently published guidelines for setting DBE goals by the Department of Transportation. I move approval.
We have a second for the motion.
Second a motion.
Ms. Mack seconds the motion. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Graham.
I want to note that having been involved in this issue, unfortunately, I wasn't at the committee meeting, but this goal is going down, down, down. Every year, we're reducing the goal. We're making the goal every year, but we're reducing the goal every year. I mean, I remember it wasn't long ago. This was 22%, if I'm not mistaken. And now we're down to 16. Is there a reason why we keep going further down on this very important commitment?
Yeah, I think there are two reasons, Mr. Graham, and we do know your interest in this issue. Number one is we have to do our very best to follow the guidance that comes out of the Department of Transportation, and they recently issued some guidance on goal setting, and there is some information that's attached to this presentation that was presented at the committee, which describes a fairly rigorous process that you really need to go to have a defensible goal. After all, the whole construct of this is that the goals need to be narrowly tailored, and they need to meet the basic tests and standards of defensibility. That's question number one. And then question number two is the theory of the program, of course, is that over time, whatever discrimination that may exist inside the program starts disappearing so that the program is not necessary because of the outcome performance, that the marketplace is just doing this without barriers of discrimination. And as you get more successful, really by definition, you're moving away from the need to have the program, because the program is working basically by itself in terms of how the contracting community are using disadvantaged business enterprise businesses. So those are kind of the two high-level explanations. I know Bill Scott is sort of able to fill in the gap because his department's had the responsibility of
working on this and kind of following the recent guidance that came out of the Department of Transportation and making sure that this year's effort was as good as it could be.
There, Mr. Lennon.
I'm sorry my colleague, Mr. Graham, was not at the meeting. We did have some fairly extensive discussions about both the methodology and the changing financial picture of Metro that would lend itself to have what appears to be a lower goal. I will add a couple things. One, that goals, as we probably know, are done on a contract-by-contract basis, so even though this may be 16% or 15%, per contract, you could in fact have higher goals. This is kind of the cumulative impact of what our floor, not our ceiling. So also, we will be looking to achievement could be a lot higher than this. This is our ceiling. This is what's recommended. The other thing that I'm very conscious of is that if you look historically, a significant portion of our goal attainment has been achieved in the area of construction. Our construction program is greatly diminished as to what it has been over the last 3 years, and I think that has continued to diminish. Most goal achievement in these areas, and this is kind of nationally, are usually higher in the construction area versus the other areas, so that will also result in some overall reduction of the goals. I too have a very, 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 very long history with this issue at both locally and a national level. I've been also ensured that we will have some continued opportunities as this board to look at the new way this program is being administered, also the program for small businesses and how they've been incorporated in the new structure of the organization. So we'll still get a chance to relook at this ongoingly, and the new methodology that's being used as well. So I think I'm comfortable with this at now, and we'll continue to monitor it.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn. Any other questions or comments on the item? Mr. Aguilera.
Very quickly, Mr. White, this just relates to federal funds, right?
Yes.
And there's no goal, though, for non-federal funds. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Correct.
And I think part of our discussion at when we met was looking into that or exploring that concept, and I think that just needs to be reinforced.
That'll be noted for the record. Any other comments or questions?
Just
Ms. Hudgens.
To reiterate what our discussion was in the committee meeting, the guidelines that we are following are guidelines that are for those federal funds through FTA's guidelines. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And while is there any penalty toward us if we determine differently, using the guidelines differently, to seek a higher goal that we might incur?
I indicated the questions that we really have to answer are two questions. Is the goal defensible, and is it obtainable? And we have to answer both those questions in the affirmative when we set the program. And the FTA, they look at that in terms of how our goals are set, the methodology, and the like. So there is concern about going beyond the guidelines. And the penalties associated with them would be, I guess, they're not identified today, but they would be involved with, I guess, I would have to turn to Ms. O'Keefe, in terms of the penalties that would be associated with.
Well, I think the penalties are the risk that you put the program under, that it would be subjected to legal challenge, I think, is the practical answer to that question.
If we should exceed our goal, we are then not at risk of doing so.
Correct.
Oh, no, as was said, that's the floor that we're trying to attain. Obviously, the goal is to do better than that, and then eventually to do it without barriers.
We historically have done better than our goal. Most part. That is the floor, and we've done better than the goal in the past.
I just wanted to comment that I do understand Mr. Graham's concern, because I think by having a lower goal from what we have traditionally seen reflects that we may have a lesser commitment. It is not what the board's commitment is that we're reflecting. We're reflecting the
the constraints under which we have to develop this goal, I think our objective of trying to look beyond what funds to include with this really gives us a lot more latitude as to what we can do with the goal. But I think it also, we can also convey that it is the board's policy, or it would be the board's objective, to seek as much of an opportunity to bring in diverse submissions for these contracts so that we can deliver those dollars and exceed the goal.
What's particularly baffling about this, to me, is that I'm hearing a message that the Federal Transportation Administration, I have that right again, is concerned that we set our goal too high. Now, I would think that what FTA ought to be concerned about is whether we set it too low. And so, you know, when you say that it has to be defensible and obtainable, if we wish to commit ourselves to an ambitious goal, you know, in terms of disadvantaged businesses, you know, and we can attain that goal, you know, that would seem to be laudable. I mean, I think the world is kind of turning on its head here. You know, we're now the federal message is that we don't want you to set your goal too high.
I don't believe that's the message, Mr. Graham. What they're trying to do is to make sure they've given the best information to agencies that they can to make sure that the goal, whatever goal that agency selects in that particular year, is as mindful as it needs to be of the specific factors that need to be determined in setting that goal, such as what is the mix of contracts that are going to be going on in that particular year. As Mr. Gordon said, there's a lot big difference between whether they're construction contracts, goods and services contracts, or professional services contracts. There's a big difference depending year to year. The mix of your projects, Mr. Graham, changes considerably. In years that we are spending lots of construction dollars, when we were doing the Largo extension and the New York Avenue extension, that supported higher goals. The second factor that they make sure that you pay attention to is the availability in your marketplace of DBE contractors for the types of work that you're going to be contracting for. So what the department has really done is tried to almost set up a formula-based exercise for all grantees to go through when they set up their goal to make it as ambitious as it can be and as defensible and realistic as it can be.
Ms. Glenn, you'll have the final word before we take a vote.
Yes, I'm not at FTA anymore, Mr. Graham, but let me just say a couple things. I think the effort here has been to try to come up with a uniform methodology that can be applied across the country that they can both defend and monitor to make sure that it's been some uniformly in the way that the agencies have applied their goal formulation. So I think that's what the FTA has tried to impose. I do think Supervisor Hutchinson's comments were ones that I think represent the tone of this board, however, which is basically to say that we recognize our need to be compliant with the FTA regulations and rules in terms of the way that we calculate and present to them our goals, because they will come back with triennial reviews and the like, and we'll then examine whether or not we've used their terminology to yield these numbers. But the board's sentiment, I think, is, quite frankly, we want to be as aggressive as we've always been. We look for efforts to go beyond what we have suggested to the FTA. And also, I think Mr. Tanglerini's comment is that we also would like to look at the other areas where we might be able to provide some more opportunities within the contracting community.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. The motion before us is on the DBE goal for fiscal year 06, and also recognizing Ms. Tanglerini's request on the staff review of the DBE potential goals for local dollars. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed?
No.
Okay, we reflect that Ms. Graham votes no, chair votes aye. Mr. Deegan.
All right, we have one final thing for the administration committee, a little housekeeping matter, approval of a resolution to amend WMATA's retirement plan. In retirement plans like WMATA, non-representative plan that contain cash out provisions, the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001 requires automatic rollover benefits with a lump sum actuarial value in excess of $1,000 be paid involuntarily as a lump sum into an individual retirement account established by the plan. The WMATA retirement plan currently contains a small account balance cash out provision under Section 12.05, Settlement for Small Pensions. Staff recommends that this provision be deleted in order to ensure continued compliance with the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. I move approval.
So motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Smith. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Next, we turn to a report by the Real Estate Committee. Mr. Graham.
Thank you. The public session of the Real Estate Committee met on July 7, 2005, and voted to recommend board consideration of the following items. First, approval of the FY 2006 Joint Development Work Program. The annual work program describes sites to be offered for joint development in the upcoming fiscal year. Each site offered has been approved by the local jurisdiction in which it is located. Upon board approval, a solicitation document will be prepared and widely disseminated to generate transit-oriented development proposals. Sites to be offered in FY 2006 are Virginia, Fairfax County, Backlick Road, Maryland, Montgomery County, Forest Glen, Maryland, Prince George's County, Branch Avenue. And to this motion, well, let me, I'll move that motion and then I'll make my amendment.
Second.
The motion is second. Discussion?
Thank you. I move to amend the FY 2006 Joint Development Work Plan to add the following projects located within the District of Columbia: the Western Bus Garage, the Northern Bus Garage, Congress Heights, Parcels 1, 2, and 3, located on Florida Avenue, northwest between 7th and 9th Streets. With respect to the Western Bus Garage and the Northern Bus Garage sites, their development is to be subject to the authorities locating, as part of the development competition, the authority having a proposal, a successful proposal, to locate suitable replacement locations for the garage functions. I want to note that the, let me move the amendment.
There's a motion. Is there a second to Mr. Graham's motion?
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Mack. Any further discussion of the item?
If I may just note.
Mr. Graham.
Did you want to say something?
Well, no, I was just going to clarify for Mr. Kaufman that that was an amendment to the original motion.
All right.
Okay. Western Bus Garage, as everyone knows, has been the subject of extensive competition. There's reason to believe that there may be some additional opportunities there. The Northern Bus Garage is really intended to be an exploratory competition, much as what we have done with other bus garages in the metropolitan area. There may not be a suitable response, but I think it makes sense to attempt that. The Shaw Howard Metro Rail station parcels is something that I think we must continue to compete. We've had successful competition with this site before. I think if we bring it back to the public attentions again, we might find the solution to what has been a knotty litigation issue. I have comments from the Office of Planning. I would add to the motion that we, to the extent appropriate, incorporate the comments from the DC Office of Planning into the joint development solicitation. Some of their comments are on target, some of them aren't. The ones that aren't are simply things, for example, they request that we solicit the opinions of key stakeholders. We do that as part of our joint development process. We don't need to incorporate that as a special provision. But where that type of thing is not covered, I think we would want to incorporate their views. So that's my report on that issue, Mr. Chairman.
Of course, as the motion is amended, any further comment? Not all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Mr. Graham.
Thank you. Following the public session, the Real Estate Committee adjourned to executive session on July 7, 2005, and voted to recommend board consideration of the following items. First, approval of amendment for procedural changes to the joint development policies and guidelines. In February 2002, the board approved the current joint development policies and guidelines, which provides that staff evaluate proposals and recommend to the board a developer to be selected for a specific site. Within 90 days after the board's designation of a selected developer, staff negotiates a non-binding term sheet. The board is then asked to approve the term sheet and to authorize staff to negotiate and execute a contract without further board review. Under the proposed amendment, the board will approve the joint development projects in two new steps. Number one, the approval of the developer selection and the term sheet, and then the approval of the contract itself. This amendment will eliminate any possibility that the term sheet could be construed as constituting a contract and eliminate the special status that developers believe they may have after selection, which makes negotiations all the more difficult. So moved.
It's been moved. Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Deegan. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Anything else, Mr. Graham?
I have one other item. From the executive session, the approval of the selection of P.M. Hoffman and Trammell Crowe Residential as alternate selected developers for the Grosvenor North Joint Development property. WMATA offered the Grosvenor North Joint Development site in its July 2004 solicitation. In response, WMATA received four proposals, all of which met WMATA's requirement for construction of a 500-space addition to WMATA's existing garage. Of the four proposals, P.N. Hoffman and Trammell Crowe Residential made proposals that were strong either technically or financially and provide WMATA the best opportunities for negotiating an overall acceptable agreement. Staff will negotiate with both developers and present to the board the term sheet offering the most favorable terms to WMATA. I move approval.
Motion, do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Ms. Mack. We have a question from Mr. Sellum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to know, is this the first time that we've selected two developers for purposes of negotiating term sheets?
No, it is not.
I'm not.
I think this has happened before. Unless I'm to be contradicted by that.
Well, my question still stands from staff. Is this the first time, and if it's not the first time, can you give me an instance where it's happened before?
Gary?
No, there you are.
Well, I think that's a legitimate question, whether it's happened before, and if so, in what instance it happened, and what was the results before, because now we're making a selection of two developers. We're going to negotiate two term sheets, or we're just going to negotiate one based on the best proposal. I don't have an objection to this particular project. I mean, the question has come up in Prince George's County, for instance. I know there were some discussions at the last Real Estate Committee meeting that I didn't attend, and there was a recommendation to select one developer's proposal when there were three proposals outstanding, and the question becomes, why not negotiate with one or at least two or three of those developers to come up with the best term sheet? It seems like we are adding on a layer in a process that hasn't existed before, at least to my knowledge. So do you propose doing the new rules with respect to Largo then? Not Largo, Morgan Boulevard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Also just ask in the future, when staff who are not at the table to comment, just to ask someone to yield so they can approach and use the microphone so we can all hear and those listening on the computer can also hear. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Mr. Lynn.
Mr. Solomon, I would assure you that one thing, you know, we are very interested in what the ultimate proposal is going to be from this process. And quite frankly, both of them have some desires at this point. We would hope through the negotiations that we would get a project that we can feel real comfortable with, and hopefully the term sheets that will come forth from those negotiations will produce that.
Other comments? If not, we do have a motion before us. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Chair
no.
Votes. And Mr. Zimmerman votes no. Chair votes aye. Mr. Graham, is that complete your report?
I just want to note that developer selection for Largo was deferred to the September Real Estate Committee meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Next, we turn to the report by the Budget Committee. Ms. Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Budget Committee met on July 14. We took several actions. One action was to amend the FY06 SAP to include the Navy Yard station modifications. The request is to add a project and to add $500,000 for the Navy Yard station entrance modifications with funding to be provided by the District of Columbia. Add one position to the FY06 budget to support the project and authorize the CEO to negotiate and execute the project agreement. Issue tasks to the on-call general A&E consultant. This project would expand the platform and entrance, add fare vendors and gates, and add escalators and elevators to accommodate the new baseball stadium. The station entrance capacity would increase from the current flow of 5,000 persons per hour to 15 per hour with one-way flow into the station from the west entrance. The staff will return to the committee in December to present full project cost estimates and proposed funding sources. I move approval.
The motion, is there a second? Is there a second to Ms. Mack's motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I was
worried. Thank you, Mr.
Smith. Any discussion?
I was waiting for Dan.
Mr. Graham had been considered not being here at that moment. At that point, I could have.
And sliding into second is Mr. Graham. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Ms. Mack, top that one.
The committee also approved the 16H extension to Crystal City and Blair Road. This is a restructuring of the regional bus line for 16H, which would start in September 2005. The change would extend the route from Pentagon City to Crystal City, eliminating passenger transfers. It would also extend the route from 4 Mile Run to Blair Road, reaching new residential customers and reducing overcrowding on other routes. The annual subsidy increase is $58,000, and the subsidy impact for fiscal 06 is $44,000. I move approval.
Second. Mr. Chairman, second by Mr. Zimmerman. Mr. Smith.
I need to reiterate comments that I made in committee in so much as the state of Maryland believes that routes that are being tweaked or modified or added to need to be offset in their presentation by other lack of efficiencies in the system and modifications with those inefficiencies to other routes in order to balance the subsidy and make it neutral without increasing subsidy during the year. We have a strenuous objection to increase subsidy at all, in so much as it also increases the baseline of the subsidy that is then exponentially increased year after year after year upon top of that. In addition, on this route, I note that the new configuration yields a revenue of roughly $6,000 on a subsidy of roughly $60,000. I would take that as a fare box recovery of 10% in a system that, in general, our overall bus recovery is about 30%, which we don't consider that to be a stellar performance necessarily. I just don't see, and Maryland does not see, the value of adding to a route that is only going to garner us an additional 10% in fare box recovery. I note that in Baltimore, the state of Maryland has restructured virtually the entire bus system and its routes to balance out and rebalance the configuration of where efficiencies and inefficiencies are occurring in the system to try to make it more productive. And initially, you know, there were press reports regarding that change that were kind of indicative of what you might expect of routes that have been in place for years having been changed. However, on further review of that upheaval, as it were, people are beginning to see and understand the need to eliminate those inefficiencies and to create a more cost-effective and productive system. So that, in concurrence with the comments I made in the committee, that I believe we need to balance out any changing of bus routes in the middle of the year to a subsidy-neutral position, we will oppose the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that the state of Maryland had if it's for me, I'm busy. I'm glad to hear that the state of Maryland has discovered the virtue of restructuring bus routes. As it happens, we've been at this for some while. As you know, Mr. Chairman, this particular corridor, the Columbia Pike Line, has been the subject of extensive analysis going back several years now, which did lead to its complete restructuring, as well as restructuring of locally provided service in coordination. That 2 years ago in September resulted in the launch of what we call Pike Ride service, which is the 16 line of Metrobus and related services in Columbia Pike. This is the most heavily traveled bus route, the most heavily traveled bus line in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We've been able to achieve a number of efficiencies and provide a lot more service for people, in part helping to reduce traffic congestion on the streets, reduce pollution in the air in a region that is still a non-attainment area, and generally improve customer satisfaction with the service we're providing. Now, in making all those changes, as I said, we found a number of efficiencies, and we have studied it over the last 2 years and made adjustments accordingly, including recently some that went into effect that are part of this year's budget as well, in which certain things were cut back, and we saved some money and put that back into other aspects of the service. I would also note that Arlington itself is putting a substantial amount of money into all of this, both because we pay most of the subsidy that's talked about under the bus formula, but also because we have specifically supplemented it with our own funds. We are paying for staff people, some of whom are employed by Metro, specifically to oversee this service. We've paid for training for bus drivers, because that seems to be a problem, teaching people exactly what the routes are, and so we have funded additional training for that. We are putting more money into things like bus shelters that are being redesigned. We've put a lot of our own money into this, but this is part of a regional service, so there is a formula that we follow. And we've had many measures that have come before this board for changes in bus service around the region, including in Maryland, the result of which is a slight modification in the subsidy allocation. And many of those times, those have resulted in a higher cost on the Virginia side because of a change that may have been made in Maryland or the district. And I have supported those time after time. And this one, I think, really brings the apparent hostility of the Ehrlich administration to bus service to a new extreme, because this terrible subsidy change we're talking about, which would be less than $44,000 for this year, is mostly paid for on our side of the river. It would be all of $3,000 out of a $1 billion budget on the Maryland side. So that's what we're talking about, for a service extension that will help about 2,000 riders a day and take off a transfer that a lot of people make and make a new connection by really what is a simple modification. That is being opposed for $3,000, which will surely net out the next time adjustments are made. This is before us today because of the schedule on bus adjustments and the need to get in for the September time frame. But when other adjustments are made, this thing would clearly be awash, certainly, in any way that it would extend to Maryland or affect them in any way. So the suggestion that this $3,000 is a part of a budget problem, I find pretty hard to believe.
Mr. Lynn, then back to Mr. Smith.
Chairman, I need to I'm curious here. I heard my colleague Mr. Smith make reference to the upheaval for the rerouting and the changes in the Baltimore area, but then as he concluded his remarks, he indicated that there seems to be some appreciation of the changes that were done by those in the Baltimore area. I'm wondering if he's equating silence with appreciation, and what measurement has been used to suggest that the changes that were proposed has now been appreciated by those who were involved initially in the upheaval. I'm always one that's very interested in performance measures and some kind of customer survey. I'm curious to see whether or not there's been some absolute data that would suggest that those who have been displaced by the change in the routing have now come to accept and appreciate those changes that have been opposed. So that's just a question that I would ask. Maybe you can provide me with that data.
Mr. Smith, is Chris be recognized? Mr. Smith?
Yes. In response to Mr. Lynn's comments, the system and its rerouting is relatively new, and there are not any definitive studies on the issue at this point, and all the information that we have would be considered anecdotal. I wanted to note, though, that the dollar amount associated with this is not the question on our front. The question is that for the past 2 years, we continue to talk about evaluating this bus system as a whole, looking for routes that are not up to snuff, as it were, and that they should be modified, and that we believe that in the mid-year that any route that is being tweaked to the positive has places in this system that could find a negative offset to make the subsidy imbalance neutral. And quite frankly, thought that we had a substantive discussion to that effect some months ago, and apparently we were having it with ourselves because there's not many folks that remember that same discussion sitting at the table. In so much as that is the case, we think we need to bring this bus system to the table and to constantly evaluate the routes that we have at hand and look for places that we can make this system more efficient and eliminate some of the routes that are not producing in this region.
Okay, before the chair recognizes Ms. Mack, I just wanted to briefly comment. Certainly, the service model we've seen brought forward by Arlington in making Columbia Pike not a transit-dependent corridor, but a transit-actualizing corridor. We've looked at that example in Fairfax in creating our REC service. And frankly, the type of changes before us today are changes to increase the ridership, so we do have that greater capture and making it more valuable. And as far as the policy question, I would just ask Mr. White, since this is before us today, obviously the policies that are existent today determine how we should view this. I'm just wondering, is there an existing policy of this board that in order to modify or increase regional service, we must drop regional service?
Well, I know we certainly heard commentary on that, but I do not believe, I'm certainly not aware of any specific actions that the board has taken as a collective whole on a policy basis that would attach each time a service adjustment has been made on in a particular bus route with an offsetting lower productive adjustment for a bus route somewhere else in the system. We do try to bring forward to the board at least once, if not twice a year, a general overview of the productivity of the overall system. But direct answer to your question, Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe that such a policy exists.
Ms. Mack?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I just couldn't let this discussion go by without pointing out that, you know, efficiency, one person's efficiency may be another person's loss of any access to mass transit. And so there are examples of communities, I actually live in one myself, that has very limited bus service, and I suspect they would, the service there would fit into the category of inefficient, but if it were removed, then an entire community would not have any access to bus service. So I just need to make that point that while we need to constantly look for efficiencies, that does not necessarily mean that any bus service that is performing in less than full capacity or whatever that accepted capacity is a candidate for removal from our system.
Thank you, Ms. Mack. Any further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all those in favor of the motion as brought forward by Ms. Mack, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Chair votes aye, and the motion fails on a jurisdictional veto.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Chairman, it amazes me that in a region which we hear over and over again has a major transportation problem, which has continuing congestion ails, air quality problems, that we would be doing anything other than looking to improve public transportation, to increase the service, to get more people to use it, to make it more efficient so that we could deal with all those problems. And yet there are those for whom the solution to this problem seems to continually be, particularly where bus service is concerned, to find ways to make small budget savings. That seems to be what we're confronted with here. That clearly is the ongoing approach in Annapolis from the governor who directs the two votes here, which have just canceled in an attempt at, you know, a fairly small improvement at very little cost. I think that that is a wrong-headed policy. In any case, we continue where we are to try and improve that service, to be able to carry more people, and to deal with the problems we have of traffic congestion and air quality, and we'll continue to do so. Mr. Chairman, I move that the board approve the extension of Regional Metrobus Route 16H on the east end of its route from Pentagon City to Crystal City, effective September 2005, and on the west end to Jefferson Street in Arlington County as a reimbursable project.
We have a motion. Is there a second to Mr. Zimmerman's motion?
I second the motion.
Seconded by Ms. Mack. Any discussion?
Just to make clear, Mr. Chairman, this means we'll do it and we'll pay for it.
All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Chair votes aye. Ms. Mack.
Oh, that's right. That took a long time on that, didn't it?
Over $3,000.
I know. And okay, I'll just hold up a comment. My next item that is being recommended to the board is approval of S-91 Springfield Shuttle Service. This action restructures the Fairfax reimbursable Metro Line S-91, which would begin in September 2005. The S-91 parking shuttle was initiated and funded by VDOT in 1999 to reduce parking demand at Franconia Springfield in association with the Mixing Bowl construction. VDOT funding runs out in September, and Fairfax has elected to fund and continue the peak of the peak service under the TAGS program, which would accommodate 75% of the current users. The funding of $110,000 from Fairfax County for the S-91 is eliminated, and the Fairfax TAG subsidy increases from $490,000 to $590,000. This has no impact on other jurisdictions. I move approval.
Chair would be happy to second the additional $110,000 pledged toward transit. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries.
The next item is approval of the FY06 training procurements. This is a approval for all FY 06 training and development programs and classes that are approved in the FY 06 budget. It includes approval to initiate and award all procurements for this program, and the approval process is similar to the previous 5 years. That is that many of these will be advertised and contractors selected for these various training programs. There are four major categories: managerial leadership, $491,000, specialized technical and professional, $1.8 million, core skills and career development, $140,000, organizational intervention, $140,000. The total funding of $2.7 million, the total is $2.7 million with $2.2 million coming from the operating budget and $500,000 from the capital budget. Move approval.
We have motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Graham. Any discussion? Hearing seeing none, all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. Anything else, Ms. Mack?
Yes, there were. The committee also was presented with a review of the May financials. The ridership continues to perform very well. The preliminary June numbers are at record high levels. Tourism, sporting, and other events pushed our off-peak service well ahead of what had been budgeted, and we're always pleased to see that. Financial results were positive revenue variance of $2.8 million for May. Expenses were favorable to budget by $1.1 million. The net subsidy variance to date is $17 million. And we do anticipate subsidy savings by the end of the year, but perhaps not at the level of what was reported in May. We should have the end of the year report at the next, well, we'll have it at the next budget committee meeting in September. We also reviewed pro forma preliminary guidance for the fiscal 07 budget. Staff provided indications of the potential subsidy level for 07, and that will be brought to us in greater detail, of course, in establishing the guidance, which has been scheduled now for our September Budget Committee meeting. Without any other actions, the subsidy increase for FY07 would be $50 million, greater than last year by a considerable percentage. That, of course, the committee discussed ways to reduce the size of that increase, and also there was a discussion of reductions that would be identified by staff to help to reduce the size of the growth in the budget for 2007. Staff asked the management to come back with several options to control subsidy growth in September when the final guidance would be presented. That completes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Mack. Next, we turn to report of the Policy and Legislative Committee. Two items to report out. First, procedure for public comment. Certainly, as we saw today, this does preserve, has some standards, but preserves discretion for the chair to ensure that we can get a range of public comments. And I would move approval for the procedures for public comment.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Graham. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Mr. Zimmer votes no, chair votes aye. Next, we turn to the discussion of the Riders Advisory Committee. At the committee level, we did discuss releasing for public comment draft formation and guidelines for the first ever Riders Advisory Committee for this authority. This is certainly something that's been looked forward to for some time, And this is, again, a draft, which is subject to further review by this authority. I move approval of the release of the documents.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Graham. Any discussion?
Mr.
Zimmerman.
I think this will give a good opportunity for additional input on the procedures for this new body, and I think that's a positive thing. But I'll say again that I think it's time we moved ahead, and believe we should. I think we should, frankly, be putting together names right now for who would be appointed and trying to get them appointed at our next meeting. I don't think it should take a year to set up an advisory committee of citizens, frankly.
Comment duly noted. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Graham.
May I request that we approve the administrative items? The reason for this is that I'm going to have to leave, and I would like to vote on the administrative items, and then I'll stay as long as I can for the customer service report.
Okay. The chair then would entertain a motion from Mr. Graham to approve the administrative actions as presented before us.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Zimmerman. Any discussion? All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Next, we turn to Mr. Smith for a report by the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee.
Yes, the Customer Service and Operations and Safety Committee met just this morning. We have one action item. On the tariff modification, the committee moves and recommends board approval of the resolution to change the WMATA tariff to establish a section to regulate the use of automatic balancing wheeled conveyances, ABWC, in the Metro system to be effective August 5, 2005, accept transfers from the DC circulator to Metrobus for customers boarding in the District of Columbia, and provide free transit services to non-uniform members of compact jurisdictions, sheriffs, and deputies' departments. So on behalf of the committee, I move approval.
Second. Moved and seconded by Mr. Zimmerman. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, the chair would just note that certainly appreciated the earlier public testimony and recognize the very poignant testimony by Mr. Dixon. I would note, though, that we do have a procedure to ensure that our disabled community can use the Segway at all times on the system. Also, I'm sure that just as our police chief has exercised great common sense and approach to the threat of terrorism, that she and her officers will also respond to Ms. Quintilla's concerns about how we address potentially out-of-town visitors who are disabled and using Segways as well. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. The motion carries.
Mr. Smith. In addition to that item, we discussed the car deployment strategies in the future as the new cars arrived in the fall, and the 2006 performance goals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Reports by the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, Ms. Hudgens.
I can't go here. You got out. There is a stream.
No report, Ms. Hudgens?
I'm sorry. This is a grand distraction. I apologize.
No,
I would say I have no report, but I do want to. Acknowledge the presence of Mr. White. He did not include it in his report, but at the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, it was very good to be able to respond to some questions that we have from legislators that are not as imminently involved in the Metro system, and you answered questions and addressed some of those issues, and I want to thank you for that, and I think it was important.
Thank you, Ms. Hudgens. District of Columbia, Ms. Mack?
No report.
WSTC, Mr. Deegan.
No report.
Thank you. The chair is looking for a motion to go into closed session. I'm sure I have one here, but I can't find it at the moment. Thank you, Mr. Scott. I move that the board meet in executive session to discuss personnel and safety matters consistent with board procedure Roman numeral 7.2.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Zimmerman. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, chair votes aye. Motion carries. We will move now to executive session.